the summer of 2017, I had the privilege of working with the World Economic Forum, the group that sponsors Davos every year in Switzerland. I was asked to edit a document entitled Partnering for Cyber Resilience Towards the Quantification of Cyber Threats. This document included opinions by roughly 100 of the most A-list information security experts in the world at the time on whether we could ever quantify the amount of savings that cybersecurity might generate. In other words, it was the belief of the principal authors, one of whom was Rod Beckstrom, who at the time was the CEO of ICANN, one of the 13 internet root servers and home to .com and .net domains, that just talking about vulnerabilities and exploits wasn't resonating with the C-level or at the board level. The idea was that if you could calculate losses, like an actuarial table that insurance companies use for insuring lives or cars, and do so for software in concrete terms so that the C-suite could weigh the purchases of one set of security technology versus another based on the risk posed to their specific industry. It was a cool idea. And the paper, it's still available from the World Economic Forum. This is the story of how we might apply risk calculations to IoT and OT environments, and whether that might help secure these technologies in the future. I'm Robert Vimosi. This is Error Code.
I am Patrick O'Reilly, and I'm the founder and chief innovation officer at CyberSaint Security, which is a cyber risk management software as a solution. We are in a fairly crowded space as a software in cyber risk management. GRC, to some extent, and IRM have crossed over into our space. There are a lot of companies making claims around cyber risk management, but we're one of the very few that actually drive actuarial data into risk analysis that support multiple risk models, as risk professionals often like to work with their own favored model. And we are nimble and still fairly young. So we work with the Fortune 100, and we sort of got pulled into enterprise because some of the older products maybe dead-ended a bit on this problem set. And we were able to provide some pretty innovative solutions.
I seem to recall there was a specific formula for risk.
Yeah, the basic formula is it's probabilistic. So you've got likelihood on one side, and then you've got impact on the other. That's the simplest expression, I think, of the risk formula.
And while we're at it, what is Patrick's definition of cyber risk?
There's a lot of beautiful products in cyber. Just a little bit of context around that. You know, and I think for the longest time, you know, I certainly worked in IT back in the 90s and the aughts. And yeah, I worked in early artificial intelligence systems as well. And for a while, executives would say to the IT crowd, do what you got to do, you know, figure it out. I really don't know what you're talking about, but we trust you. And I think a lot of the products that have come into the market in cyber have this mandate sort of buried within their implementation one way or another. That is, beautiful set of visualizations, a lot of wonderful, activity around the endpoint, but not the most legible thing in the world outside of a very narrow subset of specialists, almost like monks in a sense. So I think for cyber, one of the big mandates over the last 10 years has been to find more standardization. And if you're doing that, how do you then relate that to the business? You know, how do you financialize some of those standardization models and translate data up so that it can be understood by the people who will actually be providing the budget for some of the really important things you need to do? So a lot of beautiful products, a lot of beautiful patents in our space, a lot of wonderful work has been done, but relating it all to itself, that's still a major challenge.
When I arranged this interview, I immediately thought of the World Economic Forum paper. Patrick wasn't involved in that project, but he was creating CyberSaint at about the same time.
Problem you were defining and editing some of the consortium participants, that's the problem we've been working on, you know. But we don't do it like, you know, some of the, you know, and I don't want to bash anyone in our space, but there have been a lot of market entrants who come in and say, hey, we've got a really crazy risk model here that we can explain if we sit you down with 40 data scientists. Risk management professionals don't trust that sort of thing, sort of a black box approach. They want to see likelihood and impact. You know, they want to see what it looks like. And if you are pushing data into that equation for them, they want to see what that looks like. They want to have some assurance, right, around the inputs, because it's, you know, a famous statement in our space, you know, garbage in, garbage out. So, you know, what we've done is tried to, as transparently as possible, take multiple risk models, show what we're doing in the calculation. And when we work with large data sets, you know, either at the asset level or at the actuarial level, we will have free and open discussions with professionals, because it just helps. And there's a lot of exhaustion just generally and risk management around coming up with some sort of unique score. And executives have started to say things like, so what? You know, I'm a 3 out of a 5. What, you know, what's a 3.2 mean? You know, so what? Can you visualize that in terms of some possible financial impacts? Well, yes, we can. But then the question becomes, what data are you using? You know, what do the models look like? So you have to be, we have to be very transparent in what we do on that front. But yeah, completely relevant to, you know, what you were looking at in 2017.
So I know with the national cybersecurity strategy, people faulted it for not being prescriptive enough. I'm wondering where Patrick falls on the line. Should we be prescriptive or should we not?
I'm kind of in between, because I'm with all the participants. I would love for everything to be more prescriptive. We have to be prescriptive ourselves when a company comes to us and says, look, I've got all this data. I want to automate this assessment. We're like, yeah, okay. We analyze it. We run it through NLP. We'll refine it down to the control action level. But in truth, when they went live with the national cybersecurity strategy, they have to be broad, because they have to get consensus first, right? And NIST always writes into the documents, you know, around the CSF, they always write, you know, this is designed to be really, you know, non-prescriptive. And I'm a big fan of 853 myself.
The NIST standard 800-53 covers security and privacy controls for information systems and organizations. It's pretty straightforward around PII processing and transparency, risk assessment, and system and services acquisition.
853. It's a deep pool. You know, if you look at some of the other standards, it's like a water bug skimming along the surface. It's good and it's beautiful, but it may not have the heft you need, right? I mean, and certainly in OT, you need some heft. And then the other thing about 853 I really like is we were in a research project back in 2018 with Fed adjacent large provider, and they were working on something for one of the branches, and it was about automation. We had 30 participants providing telematic data, right? And you know, where are you going to put that? Where are you going to park it? You got to park it at the control action level. So we broke 853 into its components. So for us, like AC2 isn't just account management, you know, in the monolithic sense. It's also all of the actions within account management discreetly parked underneath it. Each one of those being its own, you know, unique UUID, and then you can drive telemetry to the proper part of that control. I remember the conferences where the Chamber of Commerce would jump up, and yell like, hey, slow down. And they weren't even being prescriptive. And the Chamber of Commerce was saying, slow down, it's too much for everybody. So, you know, in energy, in OT, in water treatment, in finance, in the heavily regulated industries, they've become prescriptive over time through consensus, right? Through NERC and FERC, you know, so you will have mandates that are pretty detailed. You can see what TSA did with the directives. It had to become more, it couldn't be voluntary anymore, right? After we had gas prices, you know, going crazy for a week here on the East Coast, then there's a little bit of heft behind it. You can see what's happening in this United Health attack too.
At the time of this interview, UnitedHealthcare was facing a cyber attack, which some have considered to be the largest healthcare-related attack to date, with patient data also breached. There is a federal investigation into the attack, as well as several civil lawsuits against the provider. Patrick says the industry itself has resisted change.
You know, HHS had come out 2 months ago and said, we have every intention of being more prescriptive and tying that to Medicare and Medicaid payments. And everybody, you know, the American Hospital Association went crazy and said, that's not a great idea. We know how to do it here the best way. And, you know, you don't want to bury us in regulation because then we'll be writing how we're doing instead of actually making the changes that we need to make on the technology. I don't necessarily buy that old lobbyist story. So I'm maybe leaning more on the prescriptive side, but I'm very open to like cases with water treatment where they have like one person sitting in a control room. Totally understand that.
So staying with healthcare, it's one of the 16 critical infrastructures.
We have a few customers in health, but I mean, yeah, like the press has been talking to me all week about the United Health stuff. And, you know, one of the problems with health, I mean, to talk about device sprawl lately, you know, and having to solve data problems. I mean, there are great startups in health, but sadly, you know, in my experience, health lags a bit. And it's sad because, and I hope, and I know some people in healthcare want to change it. But think about what healthcare, what they deal with, right? You know, I mean, it's that the data is so valuable to people. It's their personal health. I mean, it's not, it should be protected, you know, and the delivery of services. I mean, people are having trouble now with this United healthcare hack because it's a payment system. It's so concentrated, the risk, it's half of all the payments have to go through this application. You know, they're not able to get their prescriptions filled. You know, small doctor's offices are not getting their claims paid out on. It's bad. It's really bad. And in Ireland and in the UK, their healthcare system attacks were bad as well. And I don't, honestly, sometimes I really scratch my head. Like one of the things I do is like, I sometimes the Irish government, because my father lives over there, will call me up and they want me to sit on like a panel. And these panels are always great because it's a bunch of Irish senators in the Dáil. And they had a health service attack. And they, you know, they were the first half of this committee meeting, they were just banging away about, oh, you know, we're not going to pay anybody. We're not paying a thing. We're not doing a damn, you know, they're not going to. And it was great. But, you know, I sort of asked a few questions like, do you have any baseline understanding of, you know, the protections you currently have in place around, you know, healthcare and services and the whole structure of how you do payments. And they were like, not, no. So, you know, with healthcare, you know, half of my family's in healthcare and I got to watch them go through the different changes as the industry matured. And my hunch, because I deal with governance in the structure, you know, a lot, my hunch is that healthcare has lagged because it was in the hands of the surgeons until the, you know, late 80s. And then management schools kind of started pushing a structure into the biggest hospitals. But they were not native to the hospitals themselves. They were, you know, they came out of other practices and fields. And then the HMOs started to get so powerful. And I just don't think cyber has been a major priority.
And other than health, there are 15 other critical infrastructures. Are there ones that stand out as the need to quantify their risk more than others?
Yeah, I would say so. You know, energy's always been big for us. You know, and I think energy is a very forward-leaning, you know, in terms of maturity. The risk teams we work with in energy, the compliance teams we work with, they were some of the first companies that maybe tailored the cybersecurity framework uniquely. So even before the financial sector profile on the CSF came out, energy companies were building their own subcategories. So we were working in system to kind of keep up with them. They take it very seriously. They've used all our risk models in system as well. We've built, additional functionality for them to be able to sort of like do issues management and turn those into risks in the register. I would say energy's huge. Finance as well, very mature, expressing a lot of interest, especially in probabilistic model FAIR that we have in system. It's big inside finance. Other sectors, MSPs that deal with the defense industrial base, very, very big. I wouldn't say their maturity is up at the level of energy and finance, but with the help of MSPs, they do get up there quite a bit. Those are the big three in system that I think, and then I would say other financial structures like, VCs who do due diligence, system integrators as well. And they touch everything. They touch federal.
Right.
So we work a lot with the system integrators also.
So maybe there's something at the federal level. Maybe there's a framework that's open enough. And then at the industry level, say water, they have their own controls that are specific to that particular industry.
I mean, I thought for a while they were going to try and turn CMMC into something like that.
The Cybersecurity Maturity Model Certification, CMMC, aligns the U.S. Department of Defense information security requirements for third-party defense industrial base partners. But even the CMMC is not all that encompassing across the 16 critical infrastructures.
There may be a broad standard that could be prescriptive, sort of best practices that hit, an optimal set across the 16 sectors. But you're right, it's got to be tailored to the unique needs of because some sectors are really OT heavy. And that's a different set of things you're looking at.
So when we talk about other critical infrastructures, say transportation or oil and gas, we're talking about PLCs out in the field. We're not talking about controls on a network.
Right. And we in system, we have, companies that have, 100,000 employees and they run hundreds of assessments. You might have, NIST moderate baseline over here. You might have human resource controls. You might have physical environmental security, all of that stuff, more human centric set of controls. But then you can also run more specifically tailored assessments for operational tech as well. And we were involved in a project to sort of baseline thousands of plants, and there were two frameworks. There was the one framework for IT and there was the one framework for OT run in parallel. So, they're different. They just have different concerns, some similarities, but a lot of difference.
And so in the case of an OT framework, can Padraic still derive some sort of dollar assessment for the risks?
No, not yet. That's mainly on IT and enterprise level cyber events, right? So the way the actuarial data actually is structured, it's in, say, 18 vectors, ransomware. It can apply to OT. So, but you're dropping it in at like tier one, the top level. Now we're working on the refinements. So breaking it out into individualized vectors across, different types of infrastructure and associating dollar values with that. But that's a slightly larger model and it's there's some tweaks involved in that. And OT uses different risk methodologies, Bowtie and Purdue and a few others as well. So, we're going to get there.
Well, that brings up an interesting point with Colonial Pipeline. It was an enterprise system that was actually attacked with ransomware, not the pipeline itself. It's with the payment system and not necessarily the devices or the network. That's all low-hanging fruit. Is that going to continue to be a problem, or are they starting to see some more deeper attacks? I'm thinking about something like Operation Volt Typhoon, which was going after the devices and not necessarily the business or enterprise.
I think, you know, because I deal with the energy companies, I think we, you know, when Volt Typhoon was announced, I was like, wow, it took a while to get announced. You know, we've known for years, I think, about the persistence of bad actors in these networks. And it's something, you know, it's like one of these, like, well, you know, maybe, they're just looking around, you know, hoping, right, that it's not, going to turn into something like a boom. But, you know, if you read the Volt Typhoon documentation out of CISA, and you get down to the TTPs at the layer where the protocols are, you know, how they're managing to hide, and they're not dropping malware, and they're just persisting by hiding inside, you know, shells and things. They're looking for operational technology. They're looking for ways to make that leap. So yeah, I mean, I think we're going to see this happen, and I hope that we don't, you know, because you look at Ukraine, right? Look at Sandworm. Look at all of that stuff. That would be disastrous. You know, it's not good. I mean, I think Ted Koppel wrote a book called Lights Out. I read it, and I was like, this was years ago, and I was like, if Ted Koppel can figure this out, we ought to be able to do something about it. You know,
one of the problems with security has always been the ROI. If I put a firewall in, and I put a next-gen this and that, and nothing happens, am I justified in making those expenditures? How do you answer a question like that?
We used to answer it by, you know, letting customers come into the risk register, build out a risk, you know, say something like, you know, misconfiguration, or, you know, access, you know, illegitimate access, or, you know, ransomware or DDoS. And then they would associate the controls manually. So they would say, okay, you know, just generally speaking, of the control framework I'm working in, I think these top 10 really relate to mitigating this one. So for example, on an OT risk, you're definitely going to see patch management, definitely going to see MFA on RDP, you know, you're definitely going to see network segmentation. So there's a dominant set of controls that are associated with any particular risk exposure. We've always done that. You know, that's a very solid approach that NIST, you know, has been suggesting for years. We believe in it. It's part of the RMF, you know. But the tricky part comes where, what are the dollar loss values associated with that individual risk? That's what we use actuarial data for, because a lot of companies just said to us, okay, I can build out a risk register, but I can't justify to my management what, you know, a likelihood looks like, you know, just a decimalized likelihood. And a lot of large companies want to work with not decimalized likelihoods. They want to work with X events per year formats, right? So we've put that in system. So now we're driving the actuarial data over sort of more intuitive visualizations on likelihood, and then relating it to the controls. We do that programmatically now too. So if you drop in these risks, you just drop in three fields: sector, revenue, employee count. You get 15 to 18 vectors, depending on whether it's, you know, the data is there for 18. It can go down to 14, I think, because there's some missing data and some exotic sectors. But once you have that, you also get the control groupings out of the box. Now you have the dollar loss values, the controls associated with it, and there are formula we use in system for automated risk reevaluation. So if you are advancing your control score, say on the FAIR model, that's, you know, resistance strength, right? Resistance strength will impact likelihood. It can also impact impact or loss magnitude as well. You know, so it depends on whether the controls are preventative, detective, or responsive. So we bucketize them that way. And we've got a nice formula that does some automated calculation of residual depending on control strength. So customers love it because as they're working on the controls, they can see the impact on the loss values as well. So now, say you want to propose a project, say you want to understand, you know, whether or not you replace all your firewalls, whether that's going to move the needle. You can model that in another part of the product. So you create a project, you drop in the technology, you then sort of speculate on what it might do to the control implementations. Just model it. And you don't have to push a button to say this project's going live. You just are sort of modeling it. So we let you do that in the remediation part of it. And it's huge because right now, I think the end of the era of IT just sort of, IT has other reasons and OT as well now to socialize this, right? It's a huge legal issue now because of the SEC. You want to be able to socialize what you're doing on certain exposures, and you want executives to have eyes on that because it spreads your risk and it guarantees your budget in a sense. So most of the companies we talk to now need that ROI. They need to understand the competing projects and what the ROI schedule might look like a little bit for each competing project. Yeah. So rationalizing the practice in terms of ROI in a data-driven way is really a big trend right now.
Let's talk about likelihood, part of the risk equation. Patrick mentioned events that demonstrate the likelihood in IoT and OT. It seems like there are very few public ones that you can call and point to. Whereas in the networking space, well, there are several examples. Everybody seems to know the risk there. So how does Patrick discuss with customers who may be skeptical the likelihood of an IoT or OT risk?
Yeah, well, you can break it down by the event in the data set. So you can look at, when the data set catches up, because it lags by a few months because you've got a team of researchers backfilling it constantly. So it updates monthly. But you can also, when there is a question around assurance with respect to a likelihood that gets a bit detailed, we can have a call and we can show them the result. So we can filter it down on the events that we know were OT-based events, and show them the size of that sample just for some assurance, because they often need that assurance, because the executives come in with the six shooters loaded up,
So CyberSaint, it's building a database based on the live data that they've accumulated over time. That provides the likelihood events that are going to trigger whatever calculation Patrick comes up with.
And loss events. So we work with Advisen. So, they do a wonderful thing with loss events. They get whatever is published or out there on an 8K first, but they also do FOIA requests for follow-ups on fines, judgments, estimates of reputational damage. So there's a time series component on the loss values as well.
And I would suppose CyberSaint is working with cyber insurance companies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we work closely with a few right now, because one of the things they're trying to figure out is what's the optimal set of, protections to have in place for a client. Also, how to carve up the risk pool, because they've been tending to write unique policies for each customer, and it drives them crazy, because you look at property and casualty, right? I mean, it's just like they push a button, you got a policy, right? So all of the cyber risk underwriters I know are trying to get more standardized, and we can help them with that.
So what I'm hearing from Patrick is that we're actually closer to the homogenization of risk than we sometimes feel we are.
Yeah, and I mean, just a little more on that. It's always been an ambition of mine, because before I got into cyber, I got into cyber through a group of people I went to school with, and they were, I would surf with them periodically. I'm a terrible surfer, but they're pretty good. And I'm just a little too tall and I can't pop up. And I'd put on my wetsuit and I'd go out with these guys and, they'd help me. But they were in cyber, and for years they'd be like, you've got to look at cyber. I was out of financial and macroeconomic modeling and AI systems. And once I saw the problem in cyber, I was like, this is, I think, one of the most beautiful problems I've ever seen. I know it looks like a mess, but for those reasons, it's beautiful, because a lot of the good work that's been done is still open sourced. But a lot of the relating different data types to each other just hasn't been done. It just hasn't been done. So like when I go up and talk to everybody at MITRE, I'm like, well, when did you guys stop mapping, you know, CVEs to CWEs? And they're like, well, you know, it was a project and, you know, but that's something NLP can handle, you know? And, you know, this is why I got pulled in. I was like, okay, what does all this telemetry mean? You know, what does it mean in context? What does it mean to have a risk score at the level of an asset? Is that even rational? What does it mean to chain assets? How does that change risk? You know, so all these problems had been thought about. And when I talked to risk professionals about them, they were aware of them, but nobody had really, you know, tried to solve the bigger problem itself. So for me, when I hear, you know, when I talk to people in OT and they're like, well, it's a bow tie model. It's, you know, it's an aerospace model, but we're using it for energy, you know, I don't care what kind of model it is. Cause that's my background. I'm sort of like, we can run that in Python. We can run that in a service and figure out how to get that into the product later. So for me, the future, we have four risk models right now. Two of them are running services. One of them has actually got a Bayesian decision network for modeling likelihood. So you're modeling the attacker and the success as they try to, you know, go across different, you know, machines or, so you're actually just modeling discrete probabilities at each node. And it's a cool way to look at likelihood. It's a different way to look at it. Right. So for me, you know, the future is big engine that can run any risk model, right? But the data types that you want to understand are assets, you know, current exploits, controls, statuses, things like that, that are all food for the engine, you know? So I think this, the days of we all have a different risk model, because, you know, even some of the largest energy companies in the world don't, they use just an impact-based model, which is crazy, but that's what they do. Getting around some of that putting the analytical power into the hands of the professionals comfortable with whatever model they're comfortable with, I think is a real objective for me. You know, so when the industry talks about standardization, you know, I think that's great. But to some extent, you know, we have tools now at our disposal that, you know, can deal with translation and can deal with flexibility around modeling. The system integrator sometimes will bring me a risk model that's quite beautiful, pretty high fidelity. It'll go all the way from sort of threat IDs across CTID to MITRE attack to asset, and then you have outputs, say 30,000 lines of code in a spreadsheet, VBA, you know, and you know, we can convert that into Python in a matter of days, you know, just with some QA is the biggest part of it. So yeah, we're closer to harmonization of risk models, and we're also closer to harmonization across standards as well. And I think that's the future on where some of this stuff is headed.
So many years ago, I was sort of ridiculed online because I talked about the digital Pearl Harbor that Richard Clark was also advocating, which never actually happened. But I think the point I wanted to make, maybe he wanted to make at the time, was that something like that will wake people up to what's going on. And what I'm hearing from Patrick is that, well, we're not going to have that, but we have a lot of little things.
Yeah, I hope we don't have the big blowout event, you know, because bad actors do have leverage right now. And, you know, the Sands Institute, for example, was doing research 10, 20 years ago on how you can, you know, take a generator and blow it up by just, getting into a network first and then just working with the harmonic resonance. And, you know, Stuxnet was the same kind of operation, right? So I hope we don't have to go boom before we figure out a way to take this more seriously. And I do think the administration is doing a pretty good job on elevating awareness about this sort of thing. And the Volt Typhoon announcement is alarming enough, I think, maybe to get it outside of of industry and into the, you know, into the hands of politicians to do some more noodling on it, because it's got to be priority.
I'd like to thank Patrick for talking about the need for more risk assessments in IoT and OT. Hey, if you're enjoying Error Code, tell a friend. I'm sure there are other people out there who like narrative information security podcasts. And I'd really like to hear from you. Join us on Discord. Search for Error Code Podcast to join the server, or go to errorcodepodcast.com to get more details. And tell me what you like, and even what you don't. Hey, I've got some great episodes coming up, including more on quantum computing, and why we need to secure ICS SCADA systems in the cloud. Subscribe today. I don't want you to miss out.